Let's open up our Bibles to the 46th chapter of the book of Genesis. And, you know, it goes without saying that in all of life's experiences, no doubt one of the most painful experiences that we can go through is losing a child. And, you know, over the years here in the church, we've had, you know, a number of people lose kids. And you know, I hate doing funerals of little kids. I just hate it. And some couples seem to weather that storm a little bit better than other couples. And we've seen some couples they've just been destroyed by it. And in fact, it actually brings the marriage to an end. I've seen couples where, you know, the wife doesn't want to touch the child's bedroom and just wants to leave it just the way that it was the day that they passed away. And they want to get out the baby book and they want to get out the pictures. And every night it's just over. And the husband, he doesn't even want to look at it. He just, no, I just want to bury that. I don't want to be reminded of it. And it just tears them apart. I remember years ago I was walking through the parking lot over here at the high school, and there was one of the moms here in the church that they had lost a daughter a number of years before that, and I noticed that she was crying, and I saw her several rows of cars away, and so I went over there, hey, what's going on? And she just almost sobbing uncontrollably, and she said, I can't remember what my daughter's voice sounded like. And she just, I mean, she was just devastated as she just thought, I can't remember what this child of mine, what her voice sounded like. Now, can you imagine the range of emotions that you would have if you were in Jacob's place, where he has been under the impression that his son has been dead for 20, 25 years? And now all of a sudden he is told, and he's got solid evidence, that was all a fabrication, that was a lie. I mean, what would it be like for 20, 25 years? You're going through the darkness every day of just being reminded that you've lost your son. And then now all of a sudden your son is alive again. And not only is your son alive, your son is ruler of the world's lone superpower at that time, and he has sent the limousines to your house to pick you up, and you're going to go back now to Egypt, and you're going to be reunited with his son that for so many years you thought was dead. And I am sure as he was packing his suitcase, he had a smile on his face that you just couldn't wipe off. And he is just so, imagine how excited, what does he look like? And you know, what has life done, you know, for him and so forth. And so this now is setting up the scene that we're about to read in verse 1. Jacob now, he's packed up all of these carts that Pharaoh has sent his way, and he's going to go see his baby boy. And so we read in verse 1 of chapter 46 that Israel, that he took his journey with all that he had. Man, he has packed up all of his. This is the Beverly Hillbillies, man, and they are on their way to the big city. And they came now to Beersheba, and notice that he offered there sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Now, you have to understand, there's a lot of excitement. He's thrilled about this, and he stops now. He's headed south, a little bit southwest. He's living up there around Hebron, and now as he's on his way to Goshen, he gets as far south, southwest as Beersheba. And this is now just on the edge of the Negev. This is now, he's getting ready to enter into the teeth of this journey. This is where the sledding is about to get tough. He's leaving now civilization, so to speak. And so he gets on the edge of this very barren place, and he decides that he's going to draw near unto God. And I think that this is really to the man's credit. Because again, you've got to understand the scene here. He's excited. He's thrilled. It's going to be exciting. I'm going to be reunited. But it also requires him to leave the land of the promise. And you remember that the last time he left the land of the promise, it wasn't exactly peaches and candy for the guy, right? I mean, it was when he left the land, it set up decades of heartache for this man. And I wonder if that's not what this scene is all about. Lord,
is this really what you want me to do? Is this, now I know what I want. I want to be reunited with my boy. I know what I want, but Lord, it requires me to leave the land. Is this really of you? Isn't it interesting how you and I talk ourselves into certain things being the will of God? Isn't it just amazing how often the will of God just lines up perfectly with our will? I mean, have you noticed that? I mean, God, it was God's will for me to end up with this automobile, and God has blessed me with this automobile. Now, my name is on the loan papers, but it was God's will for me to, and it's that, lo and behold, it's the very car I've been looking for years. It's the very color that I mean, we con ourselves so often, and we talk ourselves so often into the will of God. If you want something bad enough, we figure out a way to convince ourselves that this is the will of God. But I think to Jacob's credit now, you know, he's had his way for a lot of years. And every time he's had his way, he has shot himself in the foot. And so now he just takes some time. Lord, is this really what you want? Now notice in verse 2, God spoke unto Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Now, do not fear going down to Egypt, for I will make of thee a great nation. Now, obviously, there's fear that's involved. Again, the last time he left, it did not go well for this man. And now he's an old guy. I mean, it's one thing for life to be tough when you're young. It's quite another thing for life to be tough when you're old. I mean, as you age, you're not so much a risk taker anymore. I mean, life has kind of knocked the risk out of you. You're not excited to look risk in the eye. You know, we get set in our ways, don't we? And as we age, we like the familiar. We don't really like change. And now there's huge changes coming into this man's life, and he's responding to it with fear. And God says to the men, now look, I don't want you to fear. Notice now he says, I want you to go. I'm in this. And notice that he tells him there, I'm gonna make you into a great nation. This is gonna be a season that you and your offspring are gonna enter into. There's gonna be a fabulous growth within the family. You're gonna go from 70 people to where, as we will eventually get to it, there will be 600,000 men over the age of 20 who are ready to be a part of military service. And so when you begin to add up all the numbers of little kids and old people and women and so forth, you're talking about moving from somewhere around 70 to perhaps approaching 5 million people. And so the Lord wasn't joking when he says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. So you go for it, man. I'm in this. And so he says, and I will go with you to Egypt. You're not going to go alone. And I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph now will put his hands on your eyes. So look, it's okay to go. All right. It's yes, I've called you to land, but you see, I'm going to bring you back. All right, you and your offspring, you're going to be coming back here. And very interesting. Now, notice these three promises that I'm going to be with you. I'm going to bring you back. And notice in a very touching moment, the Lord says to him, "Your son that you thought was dead, he's going to be right at your bedside when you die." This closing of the eye, I mean, if a person died with their eyes open, then you know, their next of kin would be there to close their eyes. And that's what he is saying. This is a good deal, isn't it? I mean, if the Lord said, look, you're gonna die, and your loved ones and the ones you love the most, they're gonna be right there with you. That's a good deal. And so, look, your favorite son, this one that you've been mourning all these years, he's gonna be right there at your bedside, and he's gonna watch you go. So you go ahead, man, and it's gonna be good. And so Jacob then arose. And he went from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father, Jacob, and their little ones, and their wives, in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry them. And as you continue down through the chapter, notice that we have a listing now. These are his sons, and these are the sons' sons, and so forth. And you'll notice going all the way down to verse 26 that we read, and all of the persons that went with Jacob to Egypt, and came from his body, all of his offspring, besides Jacob's sons and wives. Notice now, there was a total of 66 people. So you've got this small caravan of people. 66 are now traveling from the land of Canaan, the promised land, down to the area of Goshen. And so now Joseph is in the land. He's 67. Joseph's wife is there. She's 68. He's got his two sons there. They're 69 and 70. And so we read now in verse 27 that the sons of Joseph were born in Egypt, two persons. And all of the persons of Jacob's house, they went to Egypt. They numbered now 70 people. And this now sets the stage for the miracle of the nation of Israel, that what the Lord does, he's going to take these 70 people and he's going to put them in this incubator, if you will. Egypt is going to become the mother's womb for the nation of Israel, and they're going to go from 70 people close to now maybe 5 million people. Now, there are people that say, oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. That is crazy. That is an impossible. How in the world could such a thing be? Now, when you look at world population growth, we're in a sharp decline. And you're talking about population growth right now of about 1.1%. That's half of what it was in 1962, 1963. There are those that say there's a conspiracy behind this. I don't know. They very well might be right. Now, understand that to go from 70 or to go from 5 million people in 430 years would require an annual population growth rate of 2.54%. And look, in 1962, 63, it was 2.2%. So why in the world are we saying, oh, it's ridiculous? Again, I mean, we're not talking about where we were for our world after world wars and so forth. Understand, they're being placed into an environment where they got plenty of food, they got plenty of water, they are there in that delta region of the Nile River. There's no civil wars, there's no upheavals to speak of. For 430 years, this is a group of people that experiences prosperity and peace. And when you've got prosperity and peace, you're going to have little kids coming out your ears. And that is exactly what happened, and God was fulfilling his promise. Now, in verse 28, he sent Judah with before him to Joseph and to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen, and Joseph made his chariot ready, went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you are still alive." We can only imagine the outpouring of emotion that was going on there. I mean, imagine how they were squeezing each other and smelling each other and kissing each other. I can't believe that it's really you. And understand, this is something that just a short while before this, they never would have imagined happening. I mean, after all, Jacob thought Joseph was dead. I'm never going to see my son again. And Joseph was doing life, you know, in prison without parole. I'm sure he's thinking, I'm never going to see dear old dad. And what is it like when you experience something that you thought was impossible? What is it like when God so works in your life and he brings what you thought would never happen? I mean, it is a praise session, and there is an outpouring of emotion that you would never think was possible. And so they're now, I wonder, what were the other brothers doing? Because, you know, they, after all, were the masterminds behind all of this pain. And so they're just probably just staring down at the ground, I imagine. And so Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "Now I'm going to go up and I'm going to tell Pharaoh, I'm going to say that my brothers and my father's house, who are in the land of Canaan, that they've come to me, and the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have, so that they so it shall be that Pharaoh, when he calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth even to now, both we and also our fathers, that we may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, so after they've you know, gone through the meet and greet, and all the emotion now has been spent, and now they've got to make arrangements to go see the big guy, the man that has made this, of course, all possible. He now is prepping them for that meeting. And Joseph now, he's been with Pharaoh. He's been with him now, what, 10, 12 years, perhaps? He's watched him, and he's noticed that, look, he has a habit that when he meets somebody for the first time, he asks him, hey, what do you do for a living? And, you know, I kind of like this Pharaoh. I think he seems like a decent guy. And that's what we oftentimes do. After we meet somebody, hey, what do you do for a living? And usually what a person does for a living, sometimes that gives us some insight into who they are, what makes them tick, and so forth. And Pharaoh was the same way. And so, look, I know this guy. And this guy is eventually going to ask, hey, what do you do for a living? Now, what I want you to make sure you tell this guy, even though you might hear, leading up to this meeting, you might hear they don't care much for shepherds, you might want to fudge on your occupation a little bit. Well, don't do that, right? You make sure you tell him that you're a shepherd. Now, he tells us this for two reasons. Notice that he says, you tell him that you're shepherds. Notice that, all right, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. I want you in Goshen. See, if you fudge on this occupation and you tell him, you know, you're whatever, he's going to say, hey, I want you to live next door to me, all right? I want you right here in the city. Now, he knows this culture is an evil culture. He's a great young man, terrific young man. He has been able to withstand the pressure of the culture. He also knows what his brothers are capable of, and he does not want his brothers in the city. Within 10 minutes, they'll be down the casino and they will blow their entire paycheck, right? So he wants them out in the country. You make sure you tell Pharaoh you're shepherds. Now, they hated shepherds because shepherds at one point had invaded the land. And various tribes of shepherds had come in and left a very sour taste in the Egyptians' mouth. And so they don't like shepherds. And it's not that it's a bad occupation. It just conjures up some bad memories for them, all right? And so I want you to make sure that you're living there in the land of Goshen. And so the big day comes. Now they're gonna meet Pharaoh. So in chapter 47, now we find this big meeting. First, they bring the brothers in, and just like Joseph said, Pharaoh says, "Hey, what do you boys do for a living?" And they say, "Well, we are shepherds." Now notice in verse 7 of chapter 47, this had to be so cool. Joseph then brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and notice Jacob blessed Pharaoh. This is classic, right? I'm sure that Joseph is thinking, Dad, what did I tell? What, Dad, what do you? Here's the old man, right? And old men are hard to control, aren't they? And so he brings the old man in, and he just walks up now to the most powerful man in the world, and he blesses him. Now understand that in that culture, and this is what the writer of Hebrews points out, that look, the superior always blesses the inferior. That's why it was so important when Melchizedek had blessed Abraham, because it meant that Melchizedek was greater than Abraham. That was the whole writer of Hebrews' point. And so now you got this old dirty shepherd walking in and laying his hands on old Pharaoh there and bless dad. No, don't touch the Pharaoh. We do not touch the Pharaoh. What did we talk about here? And Pharaoh, I mean, he's a good sport about all of this. And because I'm sure that the blessing had to do with Pharaoh's generosity. God bless this man for what he did for my boy. God bless this man, how he opened up his borders and welcomed us and has been so nice to us. Notice in verse 8 that Pharaoh, he said to Jacob, dude, I mean, how old are you? I mean, now, again, this guy has had a rough life. I mean, this guy has gone through some, I mean, there's been a lot of stress. He's going to point that out here in just a little bit. And you and I, we're not designed for stress. The more peaceful, the calmer you can make your life, the healthier you're going to be, the better off you're going to. You ever go to your class reunion? And I mean, you see some people, I mean, they look like death warmed over. And you know, hey, there's a lot of hard living behind that face. A lot of hard living behind those deep wrinkles. And then other people, they look pretty good. And so here's this man, 130 years old. 130 years of some hard living. And Pharaoh looks at this dude and says, "Geesh, how old are you, man? You look ancient. You know you don't look good when somebody asks you that, right?" And so Jacob now noticed that he said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. And they have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Gee, you think I look bad. You should have seen my dad and my granddad. I mean, they were really, really, really old. Now, notice the two truths that this man tells us about life. This is a 130-year-old guy. This guy that knows something. If you can ever talk with a 130-year-old guy, you're probably going to learn a few things. And notice that he says two things about life. Number one, it is short. It is short. Now, this guy's lived 130 years, and he says, life is short. My days have been few. It has just flown by. I can't believe it. I mean, I never thought I'd make it to 130, and now I'm amazed at how fast I got to 130. And notice the second thing that he says there, it has been full of problems. It's been full of life. Life is hard, and life has its share of disappointments, especially when you live like an idiot, as this guy had lived for so many years. And so much of the problems and so much of the turmoil that came into his life was a result of just his bad decisions. And so notice then, once again, verse 10, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Again, he does it again. And went out from before Pharaoh, and Joseph situated his father and his brothers, and gave them possessions in the land of Egypt, and he blessed them in the land of Ramses, and Pharaoh, as Pharaoh had commanded, and Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all of his father's household with bread according to the numbers of their families. And so notice now, he's creating an environment where these guys are greatly blessed. They're given plenty of food. They're given the choicest land. Remember now that so many of them, because this is all up against the backdrop of the grips of a severe famine. This famine is so severe that it threatens the existence of Egypt itself. And you remember that many of the people have been moving into the cities because that's the only place where there's food. But yet they're now down in this delta region, and they're being taken care of. Now, the thing that we have to remember here, and as you continue now in this chapter, we're told here that the people have spent all of their money on grain. Nobody has any money. All the money, they've emptied their bank accounts. They've taken everything that they have down to the pawn shop, and they are fresh out of money. So then you'll notice that they then brought their livestock, and they got rid of their livestock, and they gave their livestock to Joseph. Now understand, Joseph has all of the money in Egypt. And now he has all of the livestock in Egypt. And then as you continue, notice that they eventually now have to start giving up the land. All of the land now goes to Joseph. Now, there are people that will say, well, that's just mean, all right? That's Joseph is a big meanie. He needs to share the wealth. I mean, there needs to be some kindness here, for crying out loud. They're in the midst here of the famine. Now, first of all, everybody knew the famine was coming. Everybody was told, big famine, might kill you. You better get ready for it, all right? Everybody had the same information, all right? So Joseph, he takes that information and he gets ready for the famine. And because he's the one that got ready for the famine, he's the one that's now cashing in when things get real serious. Now, he also is a smart guy. And what he understands is that if you give, now understand, this is a famine that might threaten the existence of Egypt. Egypt is going to be the mother's womb for this nation that his family is going to become. If Egypt goes under, then this whole plan of them becoming a great nation there in Egypt is going to go under as well. He's got to keep Egypt afloat. And he's a smart guy that knows you start giving stuff away, what do people do? Oh, they waste it, right? I mean, if something doesn't cost you anything, what do? Hey, just whatever, throw it away. And if he's giving food away, they are not going to be treating that food as a precious, precious commodity. But if it takes them everything they have and own to get it, They're not gonna be throwing away table scraps, right? You can go through the dumpster behind your house and there isn't gonna be a lick of grain in there. So he understands now that, look, it's gotta cost them something. And if it costs them something, then they're not gonna be wasteful with it. And so here now, he has ended up giving Pharaoh all of the land, all of the livestock, and all of the money in Egypt. Now, what he tells them there is, alert, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you grain, right? When this famine is over with, I'm going to give you grain, and you're going to go out, and you're going to begin now to replant these fields. The deal is, you keep 80%, 20% comes back to the government, all right? The tax rate is going to be 20%. Now, notice how the people respond in verse 25. And so they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over all the land of Egypt this day that Pharaoh should have 1/5, 20%, except for the land of the priest, which did not become Pharaoh. So look, I mean, they recognize, right? They recognize, I mean, this guy's holding all the cards, right? They recognize we're alive today because this guy has kept us alive. He's got all of the power. Now again, he's being very fair. He is being very fair. Notice there's no civil unrest. They're not oh, you're a big rotten creep is what you are. You've ripped us off. You conned us. No. I warned you over and over again, all right? Now, I've ended up with all your stuff because you're idiots, right? You didn't get ready for this thing. And so now I'm going to give you a break, right? I'm going to give you guys don't have to come up with a down payment in order that you can get out your spring crops. I'm going to give you your seed corn, all right? But then in the harvest time, 20%, all right? It's going to come to Pharaoh, 80%. So look, this guy, he could have demanded anything, right? I mean, he's got everything. He could demand whatever he wanted, and yet he's very fair, isn't he? The thing that we see about Joseph is that Joseph is not an abuser. What an abuser uses the power that they have to extract from others what it is that they want. When you look at a pedophile, what is a pedophile? A pedophile uses their power, whether it's a position, whether they're a priest or a pastor, a school teacher, a coach. They use their position to extract what they want from their victim. And that's what abusers do. They take their power and they extract from it. Well, he's not doing any of that. He's got all of the power, and yet he's not abusing anybody. And so in verse 27, and so Israel They dwelt there in the land of Egypt and in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions, and there they grew and they multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob now lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. Isn't that great? The Lord bless, he's able to spend 17 more years with this. He's 130, and now he's 147. And so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years old. Now, again, people say, oh, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely crazy. Nobody could ever live to 147. Now, you remember in our earlier studies of Genesis, how that when you get to the flood, after the flood, there is a rapid decline of lifespan. There was something that took place. There is a cosmic, you know, radiation that's bombarding us now, that's messing up the genetic code. What is it about what they had before the flood than what we've got now that allowed them to live to these ridiculous lives? But we're going to see that just a couple of generations after Jacob, you're talking about lifespans very familiar to you and I. You're talking about lifespans 80, 90, 100 years of age. And so he lives now for 147. Now notice that in verse 29, that when the time had grew near, that Israel must die, that he called his son Joseph, and he said unto him, now, if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh, and you deal kindly and truthfully with me. And please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers, and you carry me out of Egypt. I don't want to be buried in this godforsaken place, and you bury me in there. A burial place, and he said, I will do as you have said. And then he said, swear me. Now, this guy spent time in prison, right? So he doesn't exactly believe you the first time you tell him. And you swear to me, boy. And so he swore unto him. And so Israel, he bowed himself on the head of his bed. So this is a guy. Now he knows that time is drawing very near. Notice that we're told there that the time had come when he must die. Isn't that very interesting? He must die. Reminds us Hebrews 9:27. It's appointed unto man wants to die, and then the judgment. And what we see from this man, and this is a good example for us, is that look, he understands I can't live that much longer. I mean, I got more aches and pains than I've ever had in my life, and so there's something that's going on with him that he senses my time is drawing near. And notice what this man begins to do, and we're going to see it now through the next several chapters, is that he is preparing for his death. How many people do you know that they just kind of go through life and they never give any consideration to the inevitable? How many people do you know, even in their old age, they just act like they're going to live forever? And yet the Bible encourages us to live with that sensitivity that we're this is not our home. We are not going to live here forever. In Amos chapter 4, the prophet says, now prepare to meet your God. And how often do we consciously think of that? How often do we consciously make ourselves aware, one day I'm going to stand before the one that has given me life. One day I'm going to stand before, can you say that you are relegating a certain amount of your thought life and your energy to preparing for that meeting? You know, if you had a big interview, I got a big interview tomorrow. You get yourself ready for that interview, right? I mean, they're going to ask me all these questions, and you're studying, and you're getting yourself all prepared because it's a big deal. Well, is it not a big deal to stand before your maker? And should we not give some serious consideration about how we will fare in that meeting? In Revelation chapter 19, verse 7, let us rejoice and exalt and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb is come. And notice that his bride has made herself ready. We got some responsibility here. And in Mark chapter 1, you remember that John the Baptist, that he's this voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. When they would have a dignitary passing through their community, there would be this herald that would be sent out from the mayor's office, apparently, that would say, now, come on, let's clean up this mess, should we? We got a big wig coming through here tomorrow at noon. So, get the refrigerators off your front porch and, the old cars on blocks, get them out of the way and fill in these holes that's here, on Main Street. And let's make this thing presentable because we got an important person. Well, look. What we find here with Jacob is that Jacob is getting ready. And Jacob is making sure that he is doing everything in his power to finish all that God has given him to do. You and I, as this 130-year-old had said earlier, oh, few are my days, few are my days. You and I, time is racing. Time is not waiting for anybody. And that the end just marches towards us. And the Bible says, get ready, get ready, get ready. Ask yourself, what do you have to do to get ready for that day? Who do you have to go to and apologize? Who do you have to go to and, tell them you're sorry? Who do you have to go there and get things right? What do you have to say to your kids? What do you have to say to your grandkids? I mean, what you think you got forever? I mean, you think that you've got, tomorrow and the next day and the next day? And I mean, do you just think you're going to live it? Well, of course not. We're not. And so, look, let's get ready. What needs to be done so that we're going to see this old man, he's going to get the end of his life, and he's going to say, you know what? It's all done. He's gonna fold himself up on that bed, and he's going to kiss this world goodbye, and he's not going to have a care because he is taking care of everything that he needed to take care of. So I think that as we go to prayer, we ought to be asking the Lord, Lord, help me to live my life on the edge of my seat. Help me to live my life realizing that today could be my last, and help me to go out able to say, look, I took care of everything that I needed to take care of.